Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Immigration Experts Discuss Remain in Mexico Program and Tent Courts. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note this call may be recorded, and it is now my pleasure to turn the call over to Benjamin Johnson. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. My name is Ben Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Thank you all for joining the call. We're here to talk about the Migration Protection Protocols, MPP, which is really more frequently referred to and commonly understood as the Remain in Mexico Program. It was a program that was launched by the Trump administration in January of 2019 with a memorandum from the Department of Homeland Security. With the launch of this policy, the administration began a historic and unprecedented effort to turn back asylum seekers who are requesting protection from persecution and forcing them to wait in Mexico for months while they wait for a court date for their claims to be heard. Since the program was launched in January of 2019, it is now being implemented in six ports of entry. In California, it's happening in San Diego and Calexico. And then in Texas, it's happening at El Paso, Brownsville, Laredo, and Eagle Pass. There are three tent courts that have been established to process some of these claims. Otherwise, the folks are getting entering the United States and having their cases heard at more traditional court settings. But the end result is that as a result of the Remain in Mexico program, there are tens of thousands of people waiting on the other side of these ports of entry. They are waiting in huddled in makeshift refugee camps, really, is the only way I think they can be described. In all, their current indications, current data suggests that there's about 55,000 individuals who have been subjected to MPP. Last week, AILA went down, sent a delegation, myself, Andrew Nieto, who's on the call, our president, Marquetta Lent, and other staff, went down to see for ourselves what this program looked like. And when we got there, what we found is a program that really is shrouded in secrecy, and what you can see suggests a complete lack of appropriate due process in the proceedings themselves. We also had a chance to cross over. We'd gone down to Brownsville and Harlingen, Texas, and we had a chance to cross over and look at the conditions in Matamoros, Mexico, and they were nothing short of appalling. I think it was a shock to all of us who had some understanding of what this might look like and what this would mean, but to see it firsthand, I think, was quite shocking. So we have with us on the call today some very important perspectives to share. First is Andrew Nieto, who is the chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association's Border Task Force and a practitioner in San Diego, been an expert in these kinds of removal proceedings for a long time. Also with us is Douglas Stevens, a whistleblower and former asylum officer working with United States Citizenship and Immigration Service, and Dana Gold, senior counsel, Government Accountability Project, and the attorney for Mr. Stevens in his whistleblower status. So I want to start just with having Andrew Nieto dig in a little bit more on what we witnessed in the delegation down there and a little bit about what this program looks like from that perspective. So, Andrew?
Thanks, Ben. As Ben mentioned, I'm an immigration attorney in San Diego, California, one of the places where the Remain in Mexico MPP program has been implemented. And last week I had the opportunity to travel to Brownsville with a team of attorneys to observe the courts there. One difference being that in Brownsville they had set up these tent courts at a secure border facility. And while I was aware of that difference, I was still pretty shocked at what we experienced in Brownsville, what we saw, and perhaps as important, what we didn't see. To start with, we had contacted the immigration courts and DHS weeks before that to let them know that we were going and we'd like to sit in at the tent court, even though by regulation all immigration courts are supposed to be open to the public, so prior approval shouldn't even be required. But despite that, we were not allowed in at all. We were rebuffed and told we would not be given access, which is the first time I've ever been told that at any immigration court. So what we do know about these closed tribunals is what little information we were able to gather from the asylum seekers themselves or by speaking to the small number of attorneys who have been able to get inside. So what we know is that the vast majority of the asylum seekers are not represented by attorneys, and they're not even given the opportunity to consult with attorneys at crucial points in the proceedings. And when you consider that these individuals are immediately returned to Mexico after their court hearings, it means that attorneys in the U.S. are unable to meet them. The only option would be for attorneys to travel into Matamoros, Mexico, to the refugee camps. Not only is that a significant logistical issue, but the U.S. State Department itself has issued a travel advisory telling U.S. citizens not to go to Matamoros because it's essentially too dangerous. Other things that have been trickling out of these closed hearings include that asylum seekers are regularly saying that they're afraid to return to Mexico, and they're being sent back anyway. We know of asylum seekers who have been kidnapped, women and children who have been raped in Mexico waiting. And this is really a concern in all Remain in Mexico MPP courts. I'm even currently representing an asylum seeker from Central America here in the San Diego MPP, who was himself kidnapped in Mexico, sought assistance at the U.S. border, and against the very rules of the Remain in Mexico MPP, was placed into the MPP and sent back to Mexico. He was only taken out of that program months later when he repeated his fear in court, and finally an immigration judge told DHS to essentially look into it. We also know that these proceedings are not being simultaneously translated for the asylum seekers. And on that point, it's important to remember that in these tent courts, it's all by video. So the asylum seeker is there by herself in this tent, what looks like kind of a double-wide trailer inside, sitting at what appears to be an office chair at a kind of a card table, and the CBP officers are hovering over them. Everyone else, the immigration judge, the DHS attorney, the interpreter, everyone is at a different location on the video. So while we were barred from the tent courts, we did eventually drive about an hour away, had to argue our way into the actual brick-and-mortar courthouse where everyone else was, the immigration judge, DHS, the interpreter, the file, just to see what it looked like on that side. Frankly, I thought that it would be one way to get a sense of what the proceedings were like. But what was particularly shocking to me was how much is happening in that second courtroom where the asylum seeker isn't even present. The interpreter, again, doesn't even interpret everything that's happening. So there are constant conversations between the immigration judge and the ICE attorney about the case that isn't even passed on to the asylum seeker. One particular thing we witnessed that was, again, rather shocking to me was an immigration judge ordered somebody removed based on a document that the ICE attorney handed up to the immigration judge that wasn't even translated to the asylum seeker, who again was remotely located down at the tents. So I have no idea what that document was, and perhaps more importantly, that asylum seeker has no idea what that document was, couldn't read it, couldn't respond to it, couldn't object to it. On the video, we watched a stream of men, women, and children who had been up since 3 o'clock in the morning, looking absolutely dazed and confused about what was happening to them. It was a real revolving door, hearings lasting a few minutes, which is really less time than it takes for a lot of traffic ticket hearings. Some cases were continued for 3 to 4 months, meaning the asylum seekers, including these children, had to return to the dangerous camps in Matamoros, Mexico, and wait. So the little we know about what's happening in these closed tent courts is disappointing, but it's also very disturbing. I did have the opportunity to cross into Matamoros, Mexico with a group for a couple of hours to see what that was like. Interesting, that was before I looked up what the U.S. State Department warning was. I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad thing. I did it in that order. But what we saw in the camps, it's absolutely miserable. And I imagine that most people picture refugee camps as being kind of very far away in Africa, but they're really right at our doorstep. And these are men, women, and children in tents in the mud, thousands of people having to use a few porta potties, a few outdoor showers, their open fire pits, and really no presence of national or international organizations there to help. What's interesting is that there's this constant stream of volunteers coming from the U.S. to bring food and help with medical care, groups like Angry Tias and Abuelas. And within the camps, we came across at one point this rather large tent that had been set up by an actual group of some political asylum seekers from Cuba who happened to be doctors and were essentially offering medical triage to their fellow refugees. Teachers who were walking around with book carts. There's also a lot of just confusion about what they're supposed to do. But the misery of those refugee camps is really quite shocking. It was very disturbing to me just as a human being to see that suffering. And together as an attorney, what I saw in the courts, the lack of due process and basic fairness, that was shocking to me as well. I guess with that, Ben, I'll turn it back to you.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. I think it's worth noting one of the hearings that we were listening in on, the judge did ask if the person wanted more time to try to find a lawyer. When they said that they did, they continued their case for 3 months. The notion that if people ask for a chance to get a lawyer that they're going to be relegated back to these camps for an additional 3 months is certainly no incentive to try to get a lawyer. It really the whole system was designed, I think, just to punish those folks who were trying to do the right thing and wear them down is kind of the sense that I got in all of this. But anyway, thank you very much, Andrew. Next, Dana Gold, who, as I said, is a senior counsel at Government Accountability Project and attorney for Mr. Stevens. Ms. Gold, I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about where things are from your perspective.
Yeah, thanks so much for letting us be part of this. So I want, my client, Doug Stevens, the whistleblower and kind of, hero of conscience here, to be able to speak at length about his experience and what he spoke up about. He has really a valuable perspective as a former asylum officer who kind of saw the beginning of the implementation of the Remain in Mexico program. But just briefly, I just want to share our job and representing Mr. Stevens, is that asylum officers are vulnerable, right, for speaking out. And we've seen what this climate of retaliation can look like for employees of conscience, civil servants who are doing their job and express concern that they reasonably about problems that they reasonably believe violate laws, rules, or regulations, amount to abuse of authority, gross mismanagement, gross waste of funds, or a substantial and specific danger to public health and safety. So federal employees have rights to raise concerns about these. We're representing three other DHS whistleblowers who have similarly raised concerns, not about the Remain in Mexico program, but about harms to children and adults in detention. We've seen the embattled situation that employees, civil servants, and employees of conscience have seen about the assault on the asylum system and this undercutting of our immigration program that really are about like the most serious harms and real violations of law. And so, Mr. Stevens is the most, recent in the line of that, these brave civil servants willing to speak out. And so he'll tell his story about how when he was essentially forced, like other asylum officers in the San Francisco office, to conduct asylum interviews, ultimately after doing some initial interviews, refused to do that, realizing that he believed that this implementing the Remain in Mexico program was illegal, violated numerous laws and treaties, and really put people in foreseeable harm's way, foreseeable danger, which is contrary to the very oath of office that they took. So we're really proud to be representing Mr. Stevens, but we want to be mindful, and the reason I'm on this call is just to telegraph that he's a former asylum officer and is no longer with USCIS, but there are other asylum officers who share many of his concerns are in this untenable situation of having to implement a law or suffer reprisal or risk reprisal. He'll speak a little bit to that, but we are are honored to be able to support Doug, who is less vulnerable than those his former coworkers who are in the situation of seeing firsthand the harms posed by the Remain in Mexico program at the front end. And we are supporting, as you'll hear, Michael Knowles, he's the union steward and the spokesperson for the Asylum Officers Union, who was a really key support for Mr. Stevens in raising disclosures both to management, to Congress, to the union, and now ultimately to the press. And we'll be representing him at the hearing tomorrow at the House Homeland Security Committee hearing looking at the Remain in Mexico program. So we're very much in this, and we're very concerned and supportive of those asylum officers who are really on the on a different end of the pipeline, seeing firsthand the violations that MPP brings to the table here. So I'll hand it over to Doug, or Ben, you can facilitate from here. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dan. I appreciate that. And Douglas Stevens, again, whistleblower, former asylum officer, why don't you give us your sense of what this looked like from where you sat?
Absolutely. And I just want to thank everyone and Dana for having me present and helping me through this process. So I want to start by saying that before I was an asylum officer, I also worked as an attorney for the Executive Office of Immigration Review in the San Francisco Immigration Court. And so I think I approached all of this maybe from a slightly different perspective than some of the other officers. When all of this began for me in July and August of this year, my intent was never to be a whistleblower or rabble-rouser. I really just wanted to reconcile for myself a policy that felt inherently problematic, and that every officer that I talked to while I was still an officer in sense finds problematic. And it wasn't really until I was tasked with actually doing the Remain in Mexico interviews that I fully grasped the extent of the problem, both the gross illegality and the obvious and intentional endangerment of a very vulnerable class of individuals. So after doing five MPP interviews, or five Remain in Mexico interviews, I came to a couple of conclusions pretty quickly, namely that it's illegal and that I could not do them, and that I didn't feel like the asylum office should be doing them. So I raised those concerns with local management in the San Francisco Asylum Office. When I also contacted my local union rep, which elevated it to the national union, there was absolutely no response from the director of my office or anyone else in USCIS. So I felt it important to contact Senator Merkley, and now I'm thankful that I have the opportunity to both raise these concerns with the press and with the Congressional Subcommittee. After doing the interviews and sitting down and really thinking about the process that I was witnessing, it became very apparent to me that the Remain in Mexico program is illegal, and it places asylum officers in an impossible position. It violates multiple aspects of our domestic immigration laws and our international obligations. And by making asylum officers, or really any government official, including Border Patrol agents, implement the policy, the administration really is requiring officers to break the law and to violate their oath of office. Really what Remain in Mexico does is it flips the asylum program on its head, and instead of offering protection under the law, or at least evaluating whether someone should be offered protection and asylum, it returns migrants to these extremely dangerous situations. It's creating a risk to public safety, and it's putting those individuals at significant danger of crime and violence, persecution, and possibly torture. I think the most important takeaway for me after conducting the 5 interviews is that the Remain in Mexico program on the inside is clearly designed to prevent anyone from passing the interview. And I think as the other attorneys in the room can speak to, by being forced back into Mexico, it significantly impacts these individuals' ability to gain any sort of protection in the United States and kind of tease them up for being denied any type of immigration benefit in the future. So that's sort of my summary, and I'm happy to ask questions or answer questions at the end if we want to get into the legal weeds a little bit. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Stevens. Now I think we can open this up to questions.
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press star one now. And our first question comes from Max Rivlin-Nadler from KPBS. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Mr. Stevens. I was wondering at what point were you giving these interviews? Were these the non-refoulement interviews, or were these further along in the process of determining someone's asylum application? And where were these interviews, and were they done telephonically or in person?
So those are all good questions. The when I refer to the 5 interviews, I'm referring to the what the administration is calling the MPP interviews, which are essentially non-refoulement interviews to see, nominally at least, to see if an asylum applicant or asylum seeker could be sent back to Mexico, quote-unquote, safely. All of those interviews, in my experience, are conducted telephonically. Officers are in their home office. They're on the phone with the asylum seeker who is in a detention facility on the border, and there is a third-party interpreter who is also on the line.
And when you were kind of, I'm sorry, this is Ben. Maybe I could ask. When you're doing those, what was the standard that was being used to determine whether there was the return was appropriate or not?
Yeah. So because the interviews are supposedly to have the U.S. government comply with our obligations of non-refoulement, the standard was the same as what's referred to in domestic immigration laws, withholding of removal. So what asylum officers were attempting to do was determine whether it's more likely than not that somebody would face persecution or torture if they were returned to Mexico. I think when I said that the interviews or the program's designed to prevent anyone from passing, it's because that is a pretty high legal standard. It's really the same as most civil litigation in the United States. And you're doing this with individuals who arrived at the border that same day or the previous day. They don't have access to representation. They don't have the ability to present any evidence really on their behalf besides their testimony. And it's pretty much impossible for anybody to demonstrate that burden in these types of interviews.
Thank you very much. Next question.
Our next question comes from Quinn Owens from ABC News. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Stevens. Thank you very much for joining the call today. If you could kind of expand a bit more on what it is you believe about this process to be illegal and how you first came to believe that. Was there a specific case that you were dealing with or a series of cases?
So I I did a total of 5 interviews. I had a couple of different experiences during those interviews that made me very concerned about a number of different aspects of the legality. After that, I sat down and really did some research and deep thinking about it and came up with a list of at least 7 reasons that the program is illegal and violates officers' oath or makes officers violate their oath to office. I wrote a memo on that and I sent that to the administration, and it's now part of a report by Senator Merkley. So you can look that up to kind of get into more of the legal weeds. But I guess some of the examples that I can give is that I don't believe the office has jurisdiction. Well, first, let me say that I don't believe that there is any legal authority within the Immigration and Nationality Act for these interviews to exist. So first off, they just shouldn't be happening the way that they're described or the way that they are being implemented. Aside from that, I don't think that there was any jurisdiction for the office to do these interviews. For the government to have someone wait in Mexico during their immigration hearings at court, they have to first be placed in removal proceedings. And to do that, there needs to be certain documentation that is given both to the asylum seeker and to the immigration court. For none of the interviews that I did, had asylum seekers received that documentation, and that documentation was also not sent to the asylum office. So really, there was nothing to establish the jurisdiction or really the legal authority for the offices to be doing these interviews. That's one. I think also the interviews have serious implications for individuals' due rights. We as officers were told that we were not allowing applicants to have legal representation. So whereas before, under a credible fear interview or an affirmative asylum application, individuals have the right to have representation at their own expense, here we were affirmatively denying that right. We would not reschedule interviews if someone asked for representation. And so we're forcing these individuals to go through a very difficult interview, and one that asks something of them that they really can't prove without the any sort of assistance.
Got it. Thank you.
All right. Next question.
Our next question comes from Travis Bubnick from Courthouse News. Please go ahead.
Hey, yeah, this is also for Mr. Stevens. I'm wondering if you can, and to whatever extent you can you tell us a little bit about the people you were interviewing, these 5 interviews they did? I mean, like, what were some of their stories?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I want to protect people's privacy. In all of the interviews that I did were individuals from Central America. All of them were families. It was always one adult and one child. I think most of the children were in their preteens or young adults, but still minors. The stories that I, so one of the things I think to understand about the interviews is that because officers are asking or and trying to determine if someone might face harm in Mexico, we don't really discuss the reason that the individuals are fleeing their countries. So for all of those interviews, I wasn't doing my normal job as an officer in trying to determine why someone left their country and is coming to the United States and if they're at risk of harm there. People had different stories for their experiences in Mexico. They ranged from one individual who with his young son witnessed cartel members torturing and murdering other migrants and received a number of death threats and was chased because of that. Multiple individuals were robbed by the Mexican authorities of all of their money and possessions and cell phones. Some individuals received other threats on the train they were taking across Mexico or elsewhere. There was a few individuals who, fearing harm in Mexico, transited through Mexico very quickly, and as a result, didn't actually experience any harm in Mexico, but felt that they were at risk if they were to return. And for none of the interviews that I had, or any of the interviews that I've heard about from any other officer, was the asylum seeker allowed to stay in the United States.
Okay, thanks for that.
Yeah, I was just going to also add, you know, when Andrew and I, this is Ben Johnson, when Andrew and I were able to watch some of the hearings from the brick-and-mortar courtrooms, several of the folks in front of the judge, again, not clear at all how long they had been waiting for this chance to get in front of the judge, but when the opportunity came up, they, you know, the judge asked if they had any questions, and several of them said, do they have to go back? And they expressed fear of returning to Mexico. And at that point, the court, the judge would indicate that DHS needed to make some kind of or the ICE attorney needed to make some notation and follow up with a fear of Mexico interview. But we could not tell whether or how any of that was communicated to the person who expressed the fear. There's no indication of how long that was going to take. And they also had to do that, you know, as they were sitting in a room full of other people. So you could see some trepidation on their part about talking about what the basis of the fear was, particularly if they were sitting there with their child. So it really is an environment, from what we could tell, where the ability to sort of get at the truth and understand what's happening just is not conducive to that at all. Anyway, all right, next question.
And our next question comes from Ted Henson from Reuters. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate you all having the call. That's Ted Henson with Reuters. My question actually is about an interim final rule the Trump administration released today. Mr. Stevens, I don't know if you're following that, but it essentially lays the framework to send people to third countries and not allow them to apply for asylum in the U.S. And I'm just wondering what you make of that and how you think it kind of compares to what's going on already.
I don't know if I'm the best person to answer that question because I haven't read that rule. At the risk of Dana getting upset with me, I will say that I think that MPP, the Remain in Mexico program, really is part of a larger attempt by this administration to destroy the asylum program. And so I think that, with the interim final rule that you're referring to, as well as the safe third country rule, I think all of it is really designed to destroy this program and really to target and discriminate against a particular class of would-be asylum seekers.
This is Andrew. I'll also say I'm not familiar with a specific interim rule that might have been announced today, but in general, the idea that the administration would be putting forth the idea that these refugees and asylum seekers are safe in Mexico or Guatemala or whatever countries through which they're passing is ludicrous, when it's the same administration that's also issuing travel advisories against people traveling in Mexico and other parts of Latin America, and has been stating in the news that they consider most of Mexico to be lawless and run by the cartels, and that the administration in Mexico is unable to control the cartels. And so it clearly is not true that these individuals can find refuge in a third country on their way to the U.S. In fact, I would imagine that many of these Spanish-speaking asylum seekers, if they could, would resettle in other places on their way to the United States. And frankly, many do. I've even represented some that have sought protection in Mexico, have received temporary protection, and then were subsequently kidnapped or attacked or placed in danger and had to come to the United States after having had those experiences in Mexico, having fled their home countries.
Yeah, I think I also want to echo that at least one of the individuals that I interviewed during the MPP interviews had attempted to stay in Mexico initially and find work and status there and was unable to and then was endangered and fled. I think it's also kind of important to note that we receive asylum applicants from all over the world, and in particular, we get a lot of applicants from, Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. And so to the extent that the administration is saying that, no, it's actually safe for someone that's not even from those countries to remain and stay in those countries, I think is highly counterintuitive and doesn't really fit with the reports from the Department of State and other government agencies talking about the problems in those countries.
Next question.
And our next question comes from Julia Preston from the Marshall Project. Please go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for holding this call. My question is actually about the tent courts and the access and transparency in the tent courts. My understanding is that the administration has said that it's sufficient access if you do what Ayla did and go to the actual courthouse on the other end. But I wonder if you could explain a little more about what the regulation actually says about public access and attorney access to the court. And in particular, what authority the Justice Department adduced to allow a different agency to shut off the access of A, the attorneys, and B, the press to these courts?
Yeah.
Sure.
Go ahead, Andrew. Sorry.
Sure. I'll start off by just saying I believe the actual regulations are ACFR 1001.3, I believe, but I could also always follow up on that. But clearly, having access to the other side is not the same as having access to the tent courts. That was perhaps naively what I thought when we decided to go try to catch what's happening in the brick and mortar. But sitting there, perhaps I'm glad that we were forced to do that because it also emphasized how different the experience is for the asylum seeker in that tent camp at the border compared to what's actually happening and the decisions that are being made, dozens of miles away. What we were able to see sitting in front of the immigration judge and watching the interactions between the immigration judge and the ICE attorney and the documents that were being handed back and forth just would not have been we wouldn't have been aware of that if we were at the tent courts because what's happening there is not being translated back down there. And so the asylum seeker doesn't even know everything that's, the literal life and death decisions that are being made are not being translated to them. I think that one way that they're trying to justify the lack of access is by holding these proceedings in these what they would call secure CBP facilities and saying, well, these are at the ports of entry where there's a heightened need for security and we need to have better monitoring of who's coming in and who's going out, which I suppose that there's some truth that there needs to be some higher level of security at a port of entry compared to a downtown, office building. But it was their decision to place these immigration proceedings in these quickly constructed tent courts behind the walls and the barbed wires of the CBP facilities at the ports of entry. So I don't know if it was intentionally clever of them to place them at the Border Patrol facilities so that they can say there are regulations that dictate who can and cannot have access at these facilities, but ultimately the due process rights of individuals who are going through immigration proceedings should supersede any security concerns they have with barred attorneys. I never thought much of that plastic card I carry around in my wallet, but it certainly wasn't enough to get me in to see what I have a right to see as an American, a member of the press should be able to go in there. Frankly, anybody who's concerned about what's happening in their community should have the right to walk into an immigration court and see what's happening. But we were not allowed in, and not having that half of the proceeding was extremely problematic. But then, ironically, the fact that we were forced to go to that second location uncovered some of the real due process and fundamental fairness problems that exist, because we were able to see what was happening that we would not have known about if we were just down to 10 courts.
Yeah, so just to clarify, it's HCFR 1003.27 is public access to hearings section in the Code of Federal Regulations, and would agree just with everything that Andrew said, that, you know, what are the officers saying to the folks in the tent facility? What of the materials are in English versus Spanish? Whether anybody is being asked whether Spanish is their first language or whether they speak some other indigenous language. I mean, those are all things that are happening outside of the court proceeding itself and are critical to the success and the fairness of the hearing. There's just so much that I think depends on access to that other piece of the process. Okay, any other questions?
And our next question comes from Selena Tibor from the San Diego Union-Tribune. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much for holding this call. My question is for Mr. Stevens. I was wondering if you can just explain a little bit between the differences of the questions that are asked between the credible fear interview and the MVP interview. I know that you said there's some differences in the right to representation, but if you could just speak a little bit to the actual questions that are asked during the interview and the differences between the two.
I think there's two kind of fundamental differences between a credible fear interview and an MVP interview for an officer. One is, as I said before, the burden of proof that the individual has to show in order to receive what we refer to as a positive decision. And the second is where the individual fears harm. So an MPP, we're asking if they fear harm or could be subject to harm in Mexico, whereas otherwise we'd be talking specifically about their home country and why they chose to flee. Other than that, the actual interview itself is, I think, in some ways disturbingly similar to a credible fear interview. It's the same type of questions of, you know, were you harmed in the past and by who and what did they tell you, and really trying to elicit any information about why somebody was harmed or if they fear harm in the future and why they would have a fear for that harm. I think the difficulty for officers, and certainly what I found after just 5 interviews, is how easy it is to fall into doing these interviews, because in the actual conduct of the interview, in terms of being on the phone and asking those types of questions, it's very, very similar to the other type of work that officers are already doing. But it is, you know, fundamentally different in the consequences and the impact on the individual and really the ethical implications for officers.
Thank you.
Okay, next question.
And our next question comes from Julian Aguilar from the Texas Tribune. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, and again, thanks for doing this call. My question was with respect to what the folks are saying, or the folks that Mr. Stevens interviewed. We've heard a lot about the threats from cartel groups or other criminal groups. Was there any mention of actual threats from Mexican law enforcement? I'm just speaking from the Ciudad Juarez El Paso perspective, because the reporters here have heard some folks. That's one of their concerns, not only the cartels, but actual local state police officers in Mexico. And I was just curious if that was also something that that you have heard, or that you heard when you were conducting these interviews. Thank you.
I heard a number of stories of individuals being robbed by Mexican authorities. I didn't personally hear any none of my interviews talked specifically about being directly harmed by authorities beyond that criminal activity, which would not be enough to get them protection as under the Convention Against Torture or from persecution. However, I did hear stories from a number of other officers about individuals being directly threatened by the police based on their nationality or their status as migrants. I heard of someone having to interview an individual who I believe had been raped by Mexican authorities. And in none of those instances were those individuals granted the ability to stay in the United States.
Thank you so much.
This is Andrew. The other thing that I hear quite regularly is that even individuals who are threatened or harmed by non-government actors in Mexico, so cartels or gangs, if they do go to the Mexican authorities to report it or seek any type of assistance, frankly, the best they can hope for is that nothing happens, because a lot of times when they go to the authorities because of the relationship that some law enforcement in Mexico have with the cartels and the gangs, it can actually make it more difficult for them. So I have specifically spoken to people who went to the police and were basically just turned away, but also got the impression that they probably made a mistake by going to the police, but they certainly have not been given any protection or any remedy to the harm, which really just underscores the lack of the ability of the Mexican authorities to, you know, protect these individuals in Mexico.
Next question.
And it does appear that there are no further questions over the phone at this time.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. And again, Mr. Stevens, Ms. Gold, thank you so much for being part of the call. And Andrew, thank you for all of your work. If you all have follow-up questions or other information that you want, please reach out to Bell Woods or to George Tamaris, and they can connect you with whoever you need to speak to. Other than that, thank you all very much.